The Life Divine is a journey, not just a book. So, Shobindo takes us through all the various landscapes of creation. Not just landscapes, but mindscapes, soulscapes. And he takes us holding our hand. So it is wonderful, because when we read the Life Divine, it strikes us very clearly that the only way we can understand it is that Sri Aurobindo is holding us and explaining everything to us. And he does it. So when we take it like this, then he takes us through the entire journey. It's a wonderful journey. No shortcuts. It's not one summit of Himalaya from where you see the world, but the entire Himalaya and beyond, because Himalaya doesn't end here. This is the prototype, earthly representation of Himalaya, which is existing in the mind of God, if you may say so. So that's the entire journey, and obviously it begins with the human aspiration. So ordinarily, of course, we are happy just as we are, and we have some beliefs, we have some ideas about life. We are very comfortable with these thoughts, ideas, beliefs. And rest of the time we are busy with, counting our coffers. So that's okay. If that be the case, then nothing much is required. But a time comes when human beings begin to wonder the why and the wherefore of the worlds. Why things are the way they are. Not just on a personal perspective. Personal perspective is a very limited perspective. It's like when we say, why am I suffering? Well, the whole world, one way or the other, is suffering. So our personal solutions are in some way or the other connected with the larger cosmic problem. So unless we understand it, we'll just be doing some palliatives. So when this question comes that the world as we experience it, as we understand it, as we believe it to be, does not really satisfy an intuitive sense of what it should be. It's an intuitive sense. Then we begin to explore, then we begin to seek, and the aspiration emerges. This aspiration is always there. Always our journey is actually taking place on two levels. One is the outer journey from birth to death, and we would include from death to birth and rebirth and so on. But there is another journey which is going on behind. And time to time it suddenly springs up. Fortunately or unfortunately, when times are very difficult, then suddenly this inner journey springs up. That's why Sri Aurobindo has, in one of the places, says very powerfully, a little poignantly, that blessed, O misfortune, blessed art thou, for thou hast shown me the face of my beloved. It should not happen like that, but unfortunately, when our comfort zones are challenged, then suddenly it springs up, and there are enough candies and lollipops in the world to make it quiet. So sooner or later life gives us another candy, another lollipop, and we say, okay, fine, life is wonderful, God's grace. Actually, that was God's grace that we suddenly started questioning. So this is the inner thread, the human aspiration, where the Life Divine journey begins. And essentially there are two questions we are here to solve, which if we solve, we actually solve the mystery of existence. So these two questions are the fundamental questions, existence and consciousness. It may sound very strange, because normally people think birth and death. Birth and death are not the original questions, they are derivative questions. What is born? So if we understand existence, then existence is a fact, whether we like it or not. There is material existence, there is our own existence, there is the sense of I. Existence is a fact. Where has this come from? Is there an origin, or is it just suddenly, randomly, all, I wake up and I say, well, I exist and I am so and so, and it keeps changing. So there is the sense of existence, there is the material existence, of course. And the second is consciousness. And by consciousness is meant the power of knowledge. Knowledge and power or will. So these two things are always there in everything. There is the knowledge which is somewhere embedded in creation. From the atom to the galaxies, and it's amazing. That's the Veda. That's what it means. With knowledge, secret knowledge. So atoms have not read textbooks. They don't know about, you know, Heisenberg's principle or, you know, Rutherford calculations. But they behave like, you know, that. So an ant doesn't know. We study books on ants. But ant acts according to its knowledge. What a knowledge. It knows when it needs sugar. And fortunately, there are no ant doctors to tell it that you'll get diabetes. Thankfully, they don't measure it, you know. Treatment of diabetes. If you measure it, then you are in it. See, that's the problem. If you measure, there is a problem. So, ants are following, and not only they are doing it alone, as a colony. What a advanced telecommunication system. I'm sure they would beat even our, you know, communication, satellite communication system during Operation Sindoor. How they communicate? Within instance, you'll see one is there and a whole army is coming. So there is a knowledge and there is a power. Power to effectuate exactly as it wants to. They don't have a GPS. I mean, ant behavior is something amazing. And sometimes to watch the behavior of the squirrels in the ashram, it's amazing. The way they behave, the way they eat, itself, you know, a whole world of Veda getting disclosed if you look at it. Who drives and who drives the stars on their orbit? So we could go on and on. So there is consciousness, which is knowledge, and force, which is inherent in everything. These are the two original mysteries. Where did they come from? So there is a way to solve this riddle, and that it's not a solution, it is cutting the riddle. And very unfortunately and strangely, the phrase that is used for it is the Gordian knot, cutting the Gordian knot. And the phrase is used as if you are solving it by an unconventional way. And it always used to strike me, what's unconventional about cutting a knot? Any fool will do it. But that's how it is explained. So the story goes that there is a king, Gordius, in Phrygias in Greece. So what does he do? He's a very wise king. He has tied a knot to his cart. And there is a prophecy that whoever will untie this knot will rule the world. Now why I am saying this story? Because it's very interesting. It connects to Vedanta, Vedantic understanding. Conventional Vedantic understanding. Not sure Bindu's Vedanta. So everybody tries, they cannot. So Alexander, he wants to become king of the world. You know, we have nowadays also some of our modern Alexanders who want to become king of the world. So they are impatient like Alexander. Alexander is also impatient. So he tries, he cannot. He picks up a sword and cuts it into two pieces. Now, strangely, if you read about this proverb, it means finding unconventional solutions. But is this a solution? This never was the solution. The solution was to untie. What is the difference? When you untie it, then you get the complete truth about it. And in the process, you grow. But when you cut it abruptly, then you have not resolved the riddle. So one of the ways that traditional Vedanta tries to solve the riddle is literally cutting the Gordian knot. And there is a very well-known example, I'm sure many people would have heard about it. It's circulated, you know, viral videos. What is viral about it? So it says that, well, why the world you have to regard as illusion. So it gives the example, analogy of the snake and the rope. So, as long as you believe the snake is true, that is the example given, you will never discover the rope. So, you have to regard the snake as false. That's how the analogy is given. Obviously, very incomplete. Because there are many, a very critical question which has not been raised in this. So, what is the critical question? What makes one perceive the rope as a snake and the snake as the rope? Because even if we grant that, well, the snake is there, actually it's not a snake, it's a rope at the same place. But there is the problem of perception. So it's okay that I start now taking it that, well, this is a rope, this is a rope. Hopefully the snake will behave like a rope. It doesn't. Because by intellectually simply saying that the world is God, it doesn't. You have to realize it. So that's the other part between the intellectual understanding. Yes, when you realize it, the snake does behave like a rope. But here the analogy is still incomplete, but we'll come to that in a moment. The point is that what makes us perceive the rope as a snake? So the term which is used is, you know, as they say, sometimes you have to explain a mystery by greater mystery. So we doctors are very expert at that. So if a patient comes and says, I have got, you know, sore throat or something like that. So we explain it by saying, you know, you have got acute tracheobronchitis, possibly laryngitis. No, the patient doesn't know whether he did the right thing by asking this question or he did the wrong thing. Then he goes and searches Google. So you see, explaining mystery by another mystery, and that mystery is suddenly Maya. Maya makes us perceive the rope as the snake. What is Maya? Where does Maya suddenly make an entry? Like a character whom, you know, it's strange, it's real, it's unreal, because it's creating illusions. Does it really exist? But it is so powerful. How can something which is unreal create something which is so powerful? The fact is that as long as we are bound by Maya, whatever intellectual beliefs you may have, that this is not a snake but a rope, better don't go near. The snake will bite you. It's not just a question of intellectual belief. And when you realize, yes, there is a truth in it. So there is this problem of Maya which has remained unsolved. It has been said, the Gita, one of the scriptures, in fact, the one which comes closest to Sri Aurobindo. Yes, Veda in its original sense, Chaldea in its original sense do come close to that. But now what we practice is not Vedas but Vedanta. So Vedanta misses the point many places. But then Gita does speak of it, says it's my Maya. So at least one thing we know, that this not something very mysterious, it's the divine whose Maya this is. So this raises another question. Why did you put me in this Maya? This changul of Maya? You need not have put it. It's your Maya. That makes it even more difficult. But at least we know what is the origin of Maya. So at least there is the divine and his Maya. And here we are struggling to discover the answer. Now there is another problem with this analogy. I am saying this because it keeps circulating and everybody starts, and great yogis have said this. No doubt about their greatness. But it's only about their incompleteness vis-a-vis the answer that Sri Aurobindo gives. See the difference between, I don't know, it's not been done deliberately. Originally this comes in Shankaracharya's literature. But see, the analogy is very interesting. Snake is dynamic. Snake is purposeful. It can move. It's powerful. Rope is inert. So rope is Brahman. Strangely, Brahman is described as someone inert, inactive. Very strange. I don't know whether this analogy was done purposefully, because I always used to feel, why rope? Something better could have been there, you know, maybe a garland of flowers. But rope. Yes, because we regard that the divine is, or not divine, but Brahman, the ultimate reality, is inert. But Maya comes and something else happens, without going into the metaphysics, and there are people who are caught into it, who start believing and looking at it that this is a snake. And as long as it's a snake, naturally life is frightening. So this gap between this perception that we have of reality, and obviously if it is his Maya, he perceives it differently. That's why the divine, you know, that's why the divine play is so difficult to understand. His standpoint, his viewpoint, if we may use these inadequate terms, his vision of things is obviously very different from our vision. So if there is some way to exchange our vision with the divine vision, because he is also operating in the world with his Maya. He is not abandoned. If some way we can exchange our vision, or if we want to use the word knowledge, is very inadequate, because knowledge has begun to mean book knowledge, but it's not about book knowledge at all. Knowledge is the knowing the truth of things. That's what the word with literally. So if our knowledge could be upgraded to in some way to divine knowledge, not just the divine knowledge of being away from the world and discarding this world, but how the divine operates in this world, what is his operating system? And if in some way the human power, the limited human power, we can, because knowledge is not enough, there has to be also force. I may know that world is God, but I may have no force to exercise the way God acts in the world. How he acts in the world, just imagine. Suddenly a meeting is planned on August 15th and we are all going gaga. Something is happening. And something actually happens. Strange thing happens. Not the original purpose, but something else. Okay, that is the latest news, so I will not talk about it. So, what is this power? So, if our the limited human power or the power in creatures can become one with the power of the Creator, then we would be in the world even as God is in the world. That's the first phrase of Isha. Isha Vasyam Idam Sarvam Yat Kincha Jagatyam Jagat. He is here in this world, not elsewhere. It's a very profound truth. He is not only beyond, but he is also immanent. He is also cosmic, all three levels. So if human consciousness could be upgraded to become one with the divine, not only in terms of knowledge, but also in terms of power, then this worldly life can become the life divine. This is the basic principle behind the journey to the life divine. So now come the question, which we read last time. We read all the building blocks of creation one by one. Book one, we completed. Sri Aurobindo describes each of the building blocks. He describes existent, the pure existent. This is a whole chapter. Conscious force, another chapter. Delight of existence, the mysterious sap. So original mystery is consciousness and existence. But there is a third, like the little baby who is driving the whole house crazy. And that's delight. No, but for that delight, one would run away. It's not just consciousness and existence. There is the delight in manifold ways. It's expressing itself. It's expressing itself in the sea, in the forest, even in danger, difficulty. Somebody asked, why would a soul choose danger and difficulty? I said, ask the mountaineers. Ask the, you know, cricketers who face a ball coming to them at 110 kilometers an hour. There's a joy even in that. So there is a delight in creation which holds us. Ananda. So he describes Sat, Chit, Ananda. Existent, conscious for delight. But with delight he also brings the problem of delight and the solution. Because in this world we don't experience delight, we experience pleasure, pain and indifference. Then he comes to those terms with which we are familiar. There is body. What is this body made up of? Matter. So what is matter? Now all this he describes from the highest standpoint. And many times we see that how closely physics, modern physics, is coming close to this vision. And I must say this way, because very often people say, oh, see how that vision is close to modern physics. No, that's a wrong way to put it. Modern physics, with its search for truth, science in general is a search for truth, it is coming closer to this truth that is there. When Sri Aurobindo talks about matter, he speaks about seven states of matter. And there is a whole, in Savitri we have these seven immortal earths. So earth principle, Bhudevi. There is the original earth principle, Satlok. So there is the earth principle, original, and she has consented to come down here. All these stories are there in Puranas, and that's why earth is respected, prayed, worshipped in ancient Indian culture it was, because she is a goddess who has chosen to sacrifice her heavenly status and take a completely a body which is apparently unconscious. But see how it is teeming with consciousness, that just the rays of the sun, the wind and the rain. Who knows that how this earth has brought out of her innumerable elements. It's magic. It's marvel. Just looking at earth, it's an everyday marvel. Sun rays come, three things, none of which can actually directly, sun cannot create life. It gives life. If only sun was responsible and breeze and the water, then we should not bury the seed inside. We should just expose it to sun. You know, this experiment Hanumanji performs. Hanumanji wants to, you know, he is justice oriented. So in Suri Lok, Surya Dev's not wife in the sense, wife is Sangya. It's very clear symbols, I'll not go into it. Sangya is consciousness. And she cannot bear the taap of Surya, so she produces Chaya out of herself. Chaya, that's the name. And out of them is born Shani, the Lord of Justice. A very fascinating tale. Okay, let me hold myself back. Come to life divine. Okay, so, but it's very interesting that Chaya is outcast. When Surya discovers, he says, "Are you cheated me?" But actually, who has cheated? Sangya. She has brought Chaya out of herself. So he casts Chaya out of the Surya Lok into the Asurya Lok. So Hanumanji comes to know, he says, "This is not allowed." So sun, the Lord of Sun says, "He has no purpose. All the gods declare Chaya has no role. She is a useless encumbrance. She is a blot on the sun," etc., etc. So Hanumanji does a little experiment. He calls all the gods and they all come. "Why? What is this little boy, chit of a boy, trying to tell us?" So he says, "See, Suridev, it is because of you that life is there." He says, "Yes." All the gods agreed. So he puts a little seed on the ground. He says, "Please give it life." So he, in all his splendor, he starts giving it life. And Sangya puts her own energy. But the seed gets burnt. Hanumanji has done this experiment. So he says, "Well, let's try again." So as he tries again, he asks Chaya to come and stay between the sun and the ground. So Chaya comes. So all the rays get filtered and life blossoms. It's a story which explains why ignorance has been there. Because first life must blossom. Then only, before, if there is no life, there can be no life divine. Life has to blossom in matter, which is the principle of, you know, multiplicity. There cannot be just multiplicity. So see, in a small little story, beautifully it is explained why there is ignorance. So Chaya must come. Why there is avidya. Maya is avidya. She has a role to play. Direct exposure to sun will finish it. That's why even in yoga we have a long preparation before we can be ready for this. Because otherwise, fuse may blow off, mental fuse. Trying to become supramental, we may become inframental. Infradental. Yes, because how to bear that? It's not easy. It's not as simple as, okay, now I'll stay and I'll just do some aspiration. It's tremendous, that pressure. So there is a process. Now comes the question, which we took up last time. So, there is on one side the divine Maya, Vidyamayi, which knows the truth of all things, relates with everything according to its truth, according to the true law. That's what supermind is. It cannot be cheated. You can't go there and wear a nice white dress or a gerwa dress or whatever, put a tag of, you know, Swami, whatever, Alokananda or whatever, and say I am so nice, and, you know, say a nice hymn and say I need this. Supermind cannot be cheated. It sees the truth. It sees your heart. It sees everything. That's how we see in mother's life and Shrivindo's life. Somebody goes and bows before Shrivindo, and while he is lying down, thinking that the longer the pranam, the better it is, when he gets up, Shrivindo has walked away. But with Champaklalji, 1 hour Champaklalji is lying down and Shrivindo is standing. So you can't fool the divine. So it knows, that's what supermind is going to give, the true law of all things. That's why it's called truth consciousness. It is the real idea which is always behind pushing things toward their ultimate destiny. But initially it operates through the veil of avidya. Why? Because of this reason. First life must be before life divine can be. So life must reach this point up to human life, and then aspiration must pakao it. Okay, make the khichdi ready. Then will come that intense taap of the sun. Then you will have to bake it. It's a tremendous temperature. Then you will have a nice cake for the divine to eat. Then you have to offer it to the divine. So this is the process. So he says that there must be some way it is transiting. Look at the question, like a scientist of scientists. Nobody would raise this question. Because it's a satisfactory answer. Divine, vidyamay maya, he becomes a vidyamay maya. Okay, but how? What is the process? There must be some plane somewhere where the avidya and vidya are somewhere sort of coexisting or transiting from one to the other. Just imagine, that's the process. When you have landed in a new country, you belong neither to the country of your origin now, nor you have been given entry. You are still in the queue, holding the passport and the visa. You may be turned back. Exactly, this is the state. There must be some transiting line. And this transiting line, there are many original discoveries of Shrivindo, but this one of them is the overmind. So overmind maya. So the chapter, last chapter of book one we had read last time was the mind. Mind is division, as we have seen. Mind looks at a rope and believes it's a snake. And in its extreme case, when avidya is very strong, we see snakes everywhere. Everybody is bad. Everybody is horrible. That's how, you know, mind, when it is caught in an extreme state, it's full of fear and suspicion. That is the Asurya Namte Loka Pretyabhi Gacchanti. That's the Asurya Lok, where everything is just reversed. Arre, kabhi kabhi to rassi bhi dekh lo, bhai hoga. So this is how the mind, when it's caught with avidya in its extreme state, everybody's enemy, everybody's, you know, dark, everybody is bad, everybody is ugly, everybody is a devil. Some people start seeing hostile forces everywhere. I tell them, see, Sri Aurobindo has said, first see the divine everywhere. In fact, he focuses on that so much. Yes, hostile forces are there, but they have a little role, small little role. And if you see the divine everywhere, then they will become powerless, you know. Because they know who is with you and you are safe and protected. So seeing the divine everywhere. So extreme avidya leads to this situation. Similarly, vidya, it says there is no hostile force. Why? There is no world, there is no you, there is no nothing. Illusion. That doesn't solve the problem. It's cutting the Gordian knot into two halves. And as the story goes, it's so symbolic. Alexander believed that by cutting the knot, he will conquer the world, because such is the prophecy. And he missed that you have to solve the puzzle, not cut it. And because he cut it, he came to the land where the puzzle could have been solved. Actually, really conquer India. India has never been really conquered. Okay? There always have been areas which have never been conquered. Good amount of areas. If you conquer, you conquer the world, because you understand. That's what the fellow went back looking at he got the lesson when he met a mystic, and he took the mystic along with him, who said, who are you? He says, I am world conqueror. He was living in that idea that I am still the conqueror. His world ended in, Bias River. That was his world. Like all of us, my mohalla is my world. So he says, I am also an emperor. What have you conquered? He says, I have conquered myself, the territory inside me, my thought, my feelings. I am another kind of conqueror. So he is very fascinated. He takes him along. So half the truth. So there has to be a place where there is a transition between this truth consciousness and this ignorance, and that is the overmind Maya. So what is the overmind? It's like he describes as a translucent lid. On one side, it knows the truth. It is not ignorant. On the other side, it is moving towards falsehood. Not falsehood, but ignorance. Not falsehood is the extreme result of ignorance, because once you start forgetting the oneness, ultimately at some point, falsehood, darkness will be there. That's the overmind. That is the missing link which Sri Aurobindo provides. And that's why he gives so much importance to it. So we can read a little bit. We had read. He describes the overmind. We have read this, so I'm not going further. Just a few passages. Page 294. In our mind, we have the origin of the cleavage. Cleavage between the truth consciousness, consciousness of unity, and the mind as we experience. We don't experience our mind. We are caught in the ignorance. We don't even think that there is a cleavage, there is a unity beyond. The trenchant distinction made by the philosophy of the Sankhyas, in which they appear as two independent entities. Prakriti, able to dominate Purusha and cloud its freedom and power, reducing it to a witness and recipient of her forms and actions. This is avidya. Purusha has lost his freedom. This is nothing to do with gender bias, though people have used this unfortunately to bring in gender bias. So Purusha here literally goes from its root words, if you see, and there it applies to men. It's like somebody who is a silent witness. At a home, man is a silent witness. Maybe a couch potato. Everything is done by the Prakriti. So when man is overpowered by Prakriti, that is ignorance. But when man says, I will share the burden of Prakriti, then that is beginning of knowledge. So this is the beginning. Purusha, able to return to its separate existence and abide in a free self-sovereignty by rejection of our original overclouding material principle, then we say that it has come out of the clutch of Prakriti. But what about the holy marriage between matter and spirit? That remains incomplete. So Sri Aurobindo explains. Next passage. If we regard the powers of the reality as so many godheads, we can say that the overmind releases a million godheads into action, each empowered to create its own world. Each world capable of relations, communication and interplay with the others. There are in the Veda different formulations of the nature of the gods. It is said that they are all one existence to which the sages give different names, yet each god is worshipped as if he by himself is that existence. So we can take an example of a company which is run by anyone. X, Y, Z, T, P, doesn't matter. So now in this company you have say 3 or 4 main heads. So one has to look after, let us say, finances or production, let's say, you know, creator, Brahma, production. So one has to ensure quality. So whatever is not good quality, he just destroys. So we have the destroyer. Whatever is not fitting the bill, so it is destroying. And the one who has to ensure that, you know, everything is, he's the manager, like he has to manage human beings' resources, the tough job. So Vishnu Bhagwan. So they all meet together and discuss and decide. Now each one will have people working under him. and then each one still under him, and so on and so forth. Now things become very complicated, because the salesman who is standing at the door on behalf of a company, for him it's just selling a product. He understands nothing else. And if you try to raise certain questions, he is unable to. You know, medical reps have this, unfortunately, sorry, if there are representatives, they come and sell medicines. And if you start asking nutty questions, then they start fumbling, they'll open the, sir, research. So you ask, where is the research done? What is the, how was the research done? Then that's too much. So they say, sir, we'll get back to you. Because actually it's all concocted research. Largely, honestly, I am saying. And the proof is very evident. This year they bring one product. Sir, this is the best product, this, that, this, that. Okay. Next year they'll bring another product. Sir, actually this is better than the previous product. Why? Sir, there is this little problem. So couldn't you have sorted out all the problems? Come after 5 years, give me the final product. He doesn't know. See, that's the problem. So that truth, that knowledge, these three powers, they know that they are acting on behalf of the one. This fellow just knows for the sake of the name. Which company you belong to? I belong to Tata's. He wouldn't know probably if Tata passes by. There are interesting stories about it, where, you know, somebody has passed by and the person didn't recognize, because they, you know, obviously he won't recognize, because he has no direct contact. His contact with his immediate manager. That's how the overmind is that point where the board meeting is taking place between the Malik, the owner, and the three great cosmic managers. Shobindra speaks of four. Brahma as infinite existence, Vishnu as infinite consciousness, Shiva as infinite force. And which is the missing one? Krishna has infinite delight. Today is Janmashtami. We can't exclude Krishna, no? Without him. Joy of Krishna. So they are the four. And of course, Krishna is special. But for him, as he says, you know, but for his delight, he is the Anandame. He steals the limelight. Like the little baby in the house steals the limelight. People come to meet so and so. Then the baby is there always happy, busy, keeping everybody busy. And they have no time to discuss anything else. You see, children take so much attention. They absorb. And they are, of course, bundle of joy. So they go, you know, delight. That's why delight is the one which draws us. So Krishna drives us to rapture, then gives us pain. Why? First, step by step, you know, he is perfect. So he'll say, oh, this is the ultimate, my heart has sought. He or she is the one I have waited so long. Now I have found the one made in heaven, suffered upon earth. So, okay, Krishna says, come, Krishna's charm. Then after some time, say, ye kya kiya re duniya wale? Why did you do this to me? This is also Krishna's play. He drives us to weeping. Then he, after some time, okay, little better. So you see, things are improving. That's how the journey in illusion goes. It's not a meaningless journey. We grow from smaller to larger. Till we understand that, you know, many things which we think that this is love, this never was love. Love is something so deep, profound, vast. So this is how the journey goes. So that's how we see delight. So four cosmic, and as I said, Sri Krishna is so important, because he even describes in the Gita himself as the Eta the Yoni, the womb of creation. Why? Because the delights, the creation sprang forth out of delight. Existence is inert. Consciousness pushes it. Let's put it like this. Come. Existence is inert. For what purpose? For the birth of delight. That's what we see in many stories symbolically represented. For the sake of delight. Delight is the little child who comes into creation. And once the child comes, he will not stop. He will roam all around. Wherever he goes, he creates a world. So there is this, these four aspects. But as they go down the lane, many, many, many gods and goddesses, what does delight become? It becomes going to a bar and having an ice drink. Sometimes people say, it is the same thing. What is the difference? Having drinks and ananda. I said, no sir, because you have only drink, you don't know ananda. I am lucky, I have tasted both, so I can tell you there is a world of difference. Sometimes you have to explain this. Fortunately, I have tasted wine. Not just tasted. Huh? So I can say, yeah, there is a big difference. Don't confuse the two. There is a difference between the two. But if you don't know ananda, you don't know. You think it's the same thing. It's not the same stuff. Similarly, human knowledge, this is what height of consciousness. But you discover there is something much beyond. Between the human mind and the over mind, there are layers of consciousness where knowledge changes its character. Higher mind, which is like a clear daylight. Rational mind is groping in darkness, taking data from here, there, trying to piece the puzzle. That's the rational mind at best. But the higher mind, it's seeing things in a clear daylight. The illumined mind, which is like flares of the sun. Suddenly there is that, yes, that's it. Isn't it? What happens when people come to ashram? Not all, but whoever. Here it is. I know people who come and say that it's home we felt. So now try to rationally analyze. And then tell them, you know, that there is another ashram which is much better. There they have, you know, all much better facilities, much better meditation chamber. But no. That's like the sun flare. Suddenly illumined. There was an illumination. After that, a whole generation may pass. But you know why? Because that moment's discovery, that's the illumined mind. Beyond it is the intuitive mind. Intuitive mind, if you ask him, why do you feel that coming to ashram is like homecoming? The intuitive mind will not consult a single book and give you a nice lecture inspired. Revelatory, and you will end up feeling, oh my God, I didn't know about it. He'll say, where have you read it? So you say, nowhere. But there is a Veda secret in the heart that has opened. So in the intuitive mind, we have faculties waiting for our discovery. There is truth audition, there is truth vision, there is truth imagination, there is truth revelation, there is inspiration, intuition, revelation, right action, dakshina, spontaneous right action. It bypasses all the rational processes. So all this he describes in this chapter, the various faculties. I'll just quickly read that part. He's describing all these because we need to see the links. It's not like from the rational mind, suddenly there is a link with the overmind and the supermind. There are various links. And these links are important in the evolutionary journey. That's how he's describing, and he will describe all of this in great detail. Over this page 297. So in the overmind, we'll see things are as if separated. It's the beginning of separation between Purusha and Prakriti, Nirguna and Sagun. The overmind is a creator of truths, not of illusions or falsehoods. But then, down the line, what is worked out in any given over-mental energism or movement is the truth of the aspect, power, idea, force, delight, which is liberated into independent action, the truth of the consequences of its reality in that independence. There is no exclusiveness asserting each as the sole truth of being. So that's why in the over-mind, how it will look at religions, it will look at all of them, each having its own truth. The overmind will not say it has to be democracy versus dictatorship. It will say democracy has its own truth. Communism has its own truth. Capitalism has its own truth, but not as it is understood here. That's where all this gets distorted. But in its origin, See, in divine, how well they are united. In the divine, he is the greatest dictator. Doesn't sound good. Well, benevolent dictator. That's how the mother put it when somebody, mother was sitting with some disciples, and because everybody, mother has said so. Life is centered around mother. So this person, obviously from a certain background, says, mother, they call you mother, isn't the divine a kind of dictator? No. Everybody is, you know, but mother asks, because mother is there, she will give the reply. She says, yes, if you like, but a benevolent dictator. At the same time, you won't find a greater democrat than the divine. Everybody is free. If you look at the ashram, so how is it, does he reconcile it? Even Sri Aurobindo was asked that, why do you give so much freedom, such a long rope for people to hang at the end of it? He says, you can't create Superman without it. All, everything possible, including possibility of making mistakes, not one mistake. Let me not put N plus how many. Because that's the process. It's all part of the play. And then there is this. Last shot is always called by the divine, and not only last shot. In between, he'll giving a nudge here and a nudge there, and suddenly course correction, suddenly course change, we don't even realize. He brings in the sense of the unexpected. That's how Sri Aurobindo uses it. This is the hour of God. So always in life, with all the predictability that we want, there is the sense of the unexpected, and people are afraid of it. I personally feel life would be so boring and dull if everything was predictable. Imagine if a child is born and he's told, you know what, after 20 years, 21 year, 2 years, you'll become a doctor. Then, you know, you'll marry so and so person. Then, you know, you'll go through a divorce, or, you know, you will have a child, whatever. Then he will have children. How boring and dull life would be. But he just releases you, go, my child. Your parents will plan, you will also plan, but I'll call the shots. That's the beauty of life. It's the charm of life. It's the joy of life. Absolutely predictable life is a dull, and he doesn't want it. So that's the delight of life. Ananda. The joy of the unexpected. So this is how the overmind descends. So he says, how to effectuate this change? At least can we climb up to the overmind level, and at least we have some kind of a redemption. So he says, two things render that culmination more facile than it would otherwise be. Overmind in the descent towards material creation has originated modifications of itself. Intuition, especially with its penetrative lightning flashes of truth, lighting up local points and stretches of country in our consciousness, which can bring the concealed truth of things nearer to our comprehension. And by opening ourselves more widely, first in the inner being, and then as a result in the outer surface self also, to the messages of these higher ranges of consciousness, by growing into them, we can become ourselves also intuitive and overmental beings. So intuition awakes when, you know, we begin to, of course, quieten the logical mind. And if you really look back, and through an upward aspiration, so if we really look back into our life, almost all of us, don't we see that there was a moment we had a certain choice? And sometimes we look back and say, oh, thank God I made this choice. Sometimes we look back and say, oh, I wish I had made this choice. There is kind of an inner prompting. And this choice presents itself several times in different ways. So there is always this intuition. And even in the body it acts, in the body sleep. So you see, automatically the body reflexly acts. To give an example, anything which crawls up suddenly, this happens here also. You're sitting at the samadhi, and you know, then sometimes caterpillar, no, what is that called? Millipede or centipede. It will reach too close for your comfort. Then you suddenly wake up. Oh, what is it? And instinctively, you remove it. It's an instinctive reaction. Many times it's just instinctive. You don't even become aware. Because what is it? It's intuition acting. That's in animals, it is instinct. And it's so amazing to watch the play of intuition. It's active everywhere. And if we just learn to be a little quiet, be inwardly oriented, turn upwards, we'll get the messages of our intuition. So intuitive mind is the first mind that we need to reclaim. But secondly, overmind, intuition, even supermind, not only must be, as we have seen, principles inherent and involved in the unconscious from which we arise in the evolution and inevitably destined to evolve. This involution part we'll read a little bit all through. So we'll leave it for that. But are secretly present, occult actively with flashes of intuitive emergence in the cosmic activity of mind, life and matter. What is the evidence that supermind is there in creation? The whole creation is an evidence that a seed will grow into the tree it is destined to be. It may sound very, what kind of argument is this? And we'll take it up in detail in the next chapter. But just look at the amazing part. Human beings share 98.6, almost 99% genes with the chimpanzee. Kya farak hai? 1% only na. 1% has made a difference between, you know, living in a cave and taking a trip to Mars. 1%, what a marvel. Nothing, because there is that force which is driving. So we can just imagine, just a little hint, now that the supermind is operative, what it is going to do with each individual in whom it becomes more and more operative and in the world. The one word which can summarize it is a luminous chaos. Because mind has a settled order of things. Supermind is going to disturb it. Why? Because this is not what was originally intended, but it was allowed. And people who still doubt said, but some concrete example. I give them, see, how things are allowed at one point of time and how they are, the sanction is taken away. And it's a very sobering thing to remember. Because often people think, oh, this chair, I'll be permanently there. Often people say, oh, this man is doing this, this man is doing that. I say, as a child, I had heard that Ravan I Kans gaye. But Rama and Krishna live forever. So Ravan and Kans come and go. See how things get changed. Someone had asked me this question, that if everything is the divine will, so you mean the Mughal rule was also divine will? I said, yes, but temporarily. I said, where are the Mughals now? You'll be surprised. The Mughal dynasty's descendants or descendant is a tea seller in Faizabad. 200 years, that's it. The British Empire, the Raj, where the sun never sets, is worried that we will be setting. See how the supermind shifts things? It's amazing. And we doubt it. We say, oh, I am like this, I am like that. Somebody who can manage the empires, he can surely manage us. We are not that difficult. Why? Because there is in this creation an imperative truth consciousness. Shubhendu uses the word imperative. And that is the one which ultimately has the last shot. The last say. It allows the game. Like Rama, Ravana, they are playing with each other. arrows flying, Ravan is flying arrows also with the mouth. And Rama says, well, you have given your commentary, let's fight, because I'm waiting for your arrow. And it goes on. Same, Krishna sitting on the battlefield. Just imagine what warriors. Today we don't know whether they existed ever or not. People doubt Bhim and Arjun and the missiles. But somehow, Krishna and Gita have survived. That's the action of the super mind in creation. So this is the new age which has started. And at first it will lead to a luminous chaos. And we should be prepared for it. How it acts, that we will read tomorrow. We'll start the new book. Book one is over. And we'll start book two. Knowledge and the ignorance. Jai Ma.